From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And there's been reaction, of course, to the explosive New York Times report summarizing Donald Trump's federal tax returns for the last 20 years, including that Trump paid just $750 in federal income taxes in 2016 and 17, and none at all in 10 of the previous 15 years, and that he has over $400 million in debt coming due in the next 4 years. The conservative Drudge Report, once reliably pro-Trump, asks if he is a fake billionaire. Trump is denying the report with fake news. Here he is at a press conference last night.
It's totally fake news. Made up, fake. We went through the same stories. You could have asked me the same questions 4 years ago. I had to litigate this and talk about it. Totally fake news. No, actually, I paid tax.
He probably did pay some taxes, Social Security, for instance, but let's take a closer look at this devastating report with NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, who's been following this. And Franco, NPR has not confirmed details of the findings. The Times didn't print the original source documents to protect sources. But go through the big takeaways.
Well, you mentioned one of them, that he paid a fraction in his first 2 years of office in taxes, $750, compared to what most Americans pay annually. But the Times also says the president paid no income taxes at all during 10 of the previous 15 years. And these stories really paint the president as a slick businessman who took advantage of all kinds of write-offs to avoid paying taxes, while at the same time living this lavish lifestyle, even writing off $70,000 worth of haircuts. And he wrote off consulting fees that the Times say appear to be those paid to his daughter, despite her role as a top employee in the business.
We mentioned also that the Times is reporting on massive debt that Trump owes, a pending IRS ruling on a $73 million tax refund that Trump claimed over a decade ago could put him further in the hole there. How has Trump used audits as his reasoning for not releasing his taxes?
That's right. He often cites an ongoing audit as an excuse for not releasing his tax and returns. It is interesting that in this report, it does note a long fight with the IRS. And that fight with the IRS, you know, about a $73 million tax refund, that actually could have some serious financial consequences for the president after a few years, costing him over $100 million. But as you know, there is no prohibition on releasing the returns, and as presidents and presidential candidates for decades have done, but that's all obviously before Trump.
Yeah. Well, do we know anything more about Trump's dealings with foreign countries and what he might owe overseas?
Yeah, during his first 2 years as president, Trump received $73 million from foreign operations. In addition to his Gulf operations in Scotland and Ireland, foreign projects actually brought in $3 million from the Philippines and more than $2 million from India. And while the president paid $750 in federal income taxes, you know, during his first 2 years in office, he paid taxes to those two companies roughly $150,000.
President Trump has bragged about not paying his taxes before, telling Hillary Clinton in that 2016 debate that it makes him smart. We heard his denial, but how are, you know, he and maybe others in his circle responding to this report?
Yeah, they're fighting back hard. As you played earlier today, President Trump is calling it fake news. They say all the information is made up. And his surrogates are also fighting back. One of his lawyers for the Trump Organization, Alan Garten, says the information is inaccurate. But he did not give specific details on what federal income taxes the president or the, you know, President Trump paid. White House Deputy Press Secretary Brian Morgenson also talked with reporters today at the White House. You know, and he's among those who are arguing that the New York Times should share their reporting. At the same time, though, they're not answering simple questions about what the president did pay in his federal income taxes. And they argue that the president, you know, just, you know, wants to lower everyone's taxes.
Well, Joe Biden is, you know, sure to, you know, talk about this in the debates tomorrow night. But what about, you know, the president's base? Will this sway anyone? They don't seem swayable.
Yeah, I mean, that's the really big question. The president has faced explosive stories before and that they haven't necessarily stuck. And I was actually in touch with a senior administration official last night who felt this, too, would pass. The official argued that the amount of people who may be swayed enough to change their vote is likely very small. At the same time, this could be a big deal tomorrow in the debate, and Biden could use this and he could wield this very, you know, accurately.
Well, and the New York Times is saying they have more reporting that will be coming in the coming days. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, in Pennsylvania, lawmakers are rushing to educate voters about how to send in their ballots. That's because the state Supreme Court ruled earlier this month that so-called naked ballots could be thrown away and not counted. State election officials have warned that that could cause chaos in November. WHYY political reporter Katie Meyer joins us now. Hi.
Hello.
And this is one of the many court cases related to mail-in ballots across the country. So for people who haven't been able to follow this one in Pennsylvania, remind us, what is a naked ballot and what do the courts say about them?
So a naked ballot is a ballot that is missing an inner envelope that Pennsylvania requires voters to use when they are sending in their absentee or mail-in ballots. Basically, the way it works is, you know, you get your ballot in the mail and it comes with two envelopes. One is the outer envelope that'll have like a prepaid postage stamp on it that'll have the address of your elections office. And then there will be an inner envelope. So you are supposed to put the ballot inside the smaller, plainer envelope first, and then you put it into the main envelope, you seal those, and then you mail it. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court basically said, and this was just like their interpretation of existing law, and it was actually at the behest of Democrats who were trying to get clarity on a bunch of election issues and won most of them. It was mostly in their favor. The Supreme Court said, well, you know, the law seems to indicate that it's supposed to be mandatory, that this inner envelope is mandatory and that without it, we can't count ballots. So they handed down a concrete ruling on that. So now counties have to throw away ballots that come back without the secrecy envelope. And that's different because before they were kind of just deciding it for themselves. So counties had a whole bunch of different ways they were handling it. So now there is this clear-cut rule across the Commonwealth. And now there's concern that, you know, people could be disenfranchised from it.
And election officials have had a few days now since that ruling to think about how to deal with this issue. And we see that over the weekend, some local elected officials stripped down for a PSA trying to educate voters about these naked ballots. How urgent is the effort to get the word out about how to do this properly?
Yeah, well, certainly, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of creativity. I would say that especially on the part of Democrats, there has been quite a lot of urgency. And I've talked to, you know, some strategists and party officials, and, you know, they say it is an all hands on deck situation. This ruling came down and it actually took, you know, a little while for people to understand the importance of it. And sort of the whistleblower on that was one of the Philadelphia city commissioners. And she kind of put out her own estimation of how many ballots it could affect.
And what did she say?
Basically that she thought, based on the number of ballots that Philadelphia had received without secrecy envelopes in the November election of last year, it was around 6% of their ballots. So she kind of extrapolated that out and said, well, if that, you know, is consistent across the entire state, we could be looking at 100,000 ballots here. Now, that is a very hypothetical number. We really don't know what other counties were even doing before. If that's even close to accurate, obviously it's a big deal because Pennsylvania was only won by 44,000 votes 4 years ago. So, you know, people heard that and got really concerned, especially, again, Democrats. And so they've coordinated with, you know, Joe Biden's campaign, the state Democratic Party. They've been doing a lot of little like online videos and infographics explaining the issue. Republicans, there's this perception that this is going to be a worse thing for Democrats. So Republicans have spent less time on this.
Now, I've heard some comparisons, and you tell me if this seems fair or not, but comparisons to the hanging chad in the presidential race in Florida in 2000, which upended that race. Is that fair? I mean, could it be that wild?
I cannot tell you with any certainty what the impact is going to be, but this is a legal ruling based on existing state law, so it's not like some random mistake, right? And so it's just a rule. You know, it's an unusual rule. It's not a rule that many other states have. But we know about it, and voters are being duly educated. So I think it's a little bit, I would say it's different from the hanging chad situation.
Yeah. And just briefly, you mentioned other states. It is true. Other states require these inner envelopes, these secrecy envelopes. But you don't have to send it in. Is that right? How does this differ across the country?
Yeah, it's actually a little bit hard to figure out because, again, I think we haven't seen rulings like this very often. But what we do know is, yeah, 16 other states require secrecy envelopes or, you know, have that in their statute that those should be part of the ballot. Other states give counties the option of sending them. But I talked to some election experts, and the upshot that I have been able to gather is that this ruling saying that ballots must be discarded if they're not included, that's less usual. And so that makes Pennsylvania, if not unique, then certainly uncommon in terms of the situation it's facing here.
That's WHYY political reporter Katie Meyer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so maybe you heard that. Maybe you have questions about naked ballots in your state now, or maybe you have other questions about voting this year. You can let us know at hereandnow.org. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. Yes, a voicemail. If you're ready, I'm going to give you the number right now. It's 617-358-0397. Again, it's 617-358-0397.
And we want to take a deeper look now at deep fakes. Now, fake images aren't new. In the 1860s, during the Civil War, spirit photographers doctored negatives to sell pictures of ghosts to grieving relatives of the war dead. Today, we Photoshop, and during the current terrible California wildfires, completely fake videos are circulating, purporting to be of arsonists and looters. They are not. Deep fake video is a problem, but our next guest says deep fake audio may be bigger because we think we know what people sound like. Now, these aren't the funny videos where, let's say, a president's words are cut and spliced or someone else makes their voice come out of the mouths of famous people. This is artificial intelligence learning how to speak in the voice of someone else. Dallas Taylor is host of the popular podcast 20,000 Hertz. He took this up in a recent episode, Deep Fake Dallas. So, Dallas, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And by Deep Fake Dallas, this was you arguing with a fake you?
Right. So even as a sound designer myself, I really don't understand all the nuance of how you put together a fake voice. And so I thought, what better way than to actually have someone who's an expert build out my own voice, some sort of fake me? That was convincing enough to actually play and trick people. And come to find out, it even tricked my wife.
Well, and now that people have heard your voice for a bit, let's listen to the real Dallas and the artificial intelligence, the deep fake you. Let's listen.
Sorry, but who are you? I'm Dallas Taylor. No, I'm Dallas Taylor. Nope, I think you'll find. I am Dallas. You must be an audio deepfake of my voice. Have you been narrating this whole time?
So that is deepfake Dallas. The person who helped you do it is Tim McSmithers of the Speaking of AI YouTube channel, who does a lot of this deepfake audio. Some of it is hilarious. We'll have it at hereandnow.org. There's the Joe Biden with this completely rambling story about, I'm not quite sure what, including attaching an onion to his belt. Here is his voice through AI over the grandpa's image in The Simpsons.
To take the ferry cost a nickel. And in those days, nickels had pictures of bumblebees on them. Give me 5 bees for a quarter, you'd say. Now, where were we? Oh, yes. The important thing was that I had an onion on my belt, which was the style at the time. They didn't have any white onions.
Again, Joe Biden never said that. It's deepfake. Funny. But the point is, this is also really chilling. You could have a Joe Biden saying something that people would take seriously.
So what's terrifying to me about this is kind of the power of a deepfake voice coupled with the power of sound design itself. And so we're getting pretty advanced on a convincing voice, but there's still this uncanny valley to it, to where it doesn't seem like there's a soul behind it or there's not really like a real person behind that voice. But the thing that's most concerning to me is that as a sound designer, we could essentially take all those little bumps and hits that kind of go into that uncanny valley and potentially make it sound like Joe Biden is coming from a phone or a back room or something, because we can kind of take that voice and process it. Coupling that with the speed of social media, I'm concerned that if something came out, and I don't think it's an if, I think it's more of a when, things are shared so quickly that I'm worried that our kind of rush to judgments on things will come back to haunt us.
So you're saying you can smooth over the sound, let's say put a microphone bump, to cover what you call uncanny valley. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so that's kind of that space when you kind of think of something as being, humanoid, but your brain automatically goes, okay, something's very creepy about that. Right now, we're still in that little uncanny valley, but kind of right around the corner, I think it's going to become more convincing.
More human.
Right.
So I'm going to raise the question, but then are we teaching more people to do it?
Yeah, that's a bit of a moral dilemma, but I feel like it's important to really get information. You know, of course, when we're going down a story like that, we do have the moral dilemma of, do we teach someone how to hurt someone else with sound? But we really came down to the point that if we don't get this out, that whole permeation of our society thinking that sound is this magical thing that they can't understand just feeds into the problem when it happens. So there's times where I want to just dig into that to where we have an understanding of what to look for rather than it coming out of nowhere and question things that we hear. And that's really what concerns me, is that if you're already primed to know that somebody on this other side is a terrible person, it's very easy to convince ourselves that what we hear or what we see is true.
All right, well, let's give a little bit of this information, which you compare to your own daughter and how your daughter learned to speak. Here's Tim McSmithers talking about it. He runs the YouTube channel Speaking of AI.
The first kind of important step that we need to do is to teach the AI model how to read English, in effect. And so that usually happens by taking lots of audio recordings, the transcripts from those recordings, and then throwing that at an intelligently designed model, and then letting it whir away for a long period of time until it finds a correlation between the two.
Is it a little bit like Siri or any of our smart technology where it literally learns?
Right. And if there's anything that I've learned about computing, is that just the exponential rate of processing that we're living through. And so right now it takes some time and it takes some crafting, but I'm already seeing peaks of websites that you can kind of build out your own fake voice with. It basically just asks you to say phrases over and over and over again in different phrases. And at the end of it, you start to get closer to a model of your own voice. 5 years ago when we started hearing about this, it was still like, oh, that far-off thing that still has uncanny valley, that's still a little odd when you hear it. I think we've all lived through enough computer kind of going into artificial intelligence and machine learning to know that it's just a matter of time before this gets just better and better and better and faster.
But there have been legal challenges. Tom Waits sued Frito-Lay for a commercial that used his voice artificially created.
Now that tongue tape is quite a stickle. It's compound and resounding, perplex and complex and involuted, convoluted, but it sure feels good. All right.
Again, not Tom Waits. We're talking to Dallas Taylor, host of the popular podcast 20,000 Hertz and his recent episode, Deep Fake Dallas. And Dallas, you also posed questions around a case of a mother involved in a custody battle who claimed to produce an audio tape of her ex threatening her, a deep fake. The truth is, I mean, these are the questions you're raising. Perhaps courts are going to have to say they can't just accept audio tapes.
At this point, there are markers. If somebody with enough audio skill looked at these things, heard them, deconstructed it, seeing how, like, where sound seams are coming together, I think that there's still ways to debunk them, but I don't think we have much time before it's going to become easier to do.
Well, and on the other hand, there's a dividend from that for people who might have done something nefarious. If we're all assuming everything could be a deep fake, and we have a lot of this conversation already in this country, the stage has already been set for people not to believe their own eyes and their own ears. And here's Rhianna Pfefferkorn. She's from the Center for Internet and Society, and it's a point she raised during your podcast.
This is a phenomenon that the legal scholars Robert Chesney and Danielle Citron call the liar's dividend. That if you are prepared to lie and say, I didn't do that, I didn't say that, that's a deep fake, then you can reap the rewards of being able to get away with whatever bad thing it is that you did.
Right. So there's two sides of the coin here, and either one can be more terrifying than the other. So there's the one side of the coin of someone making it, leaking it strategically, say, right before someone's going to be drafted, you know, in the NFL or something, the night before. It could have massive ramifications. By the time it's even debunked, the damage has already been done massively. Scale that up to elections, and you have this thing where you can plant this little seed of doubt in either side. The flip side of the coin, which is just as frightening, is now when someone does say something terrible, or if you don't trust your leaders and you know that they do lie, it's very easy for them to just say, oh, that didn't happen. That's already been used with very clear tape before. And that's what's really frightening, is that even if something is captured, it can now be used to just sow a little seed of doubt that it was fake.
Well, companies have been tricked into giving money to thieves who use deep fake voices. You give an example of what that might sound like in your podcast.
Imagine you're a financial executive. You're working late at the office when you get a phone call from your boss.
He says that something urgent's come up, and you need to transfer $200,000 into a new account. You make the transfer and hang up the phone.
But something just feels wrong. You call him back to make sure you got everything right, but he has no idea what you're talking about. He says he never even called you, and now the money is gone.
Right. The point here that's frightening with deepfakes is that it's designed to do something in a moment that plays off of the worst of us, like the jumping to conclusions, like instantaneous acceptance of what we see and hear, especially in a presidential election year. The circumstances are just ripe for this perfect moment for something to be plopped down, whether it's somebody who wants to have it out for a certain candidate or a country that we don't trust. And I just hope that if it has some sort of world-changing effect, that the governments would be slow to react. Think about every celebrity or politician who's read their own audiobook. That gives you more than enough to do anything with. It's a full transcript, full clean audio. Same for people like us who are hosting shows, because it really just takes about 2 to 3 hours of solid talking with a transcript next to it. So if you know what you're doing, that's really all it takes.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Dallas Taylor, host of the podcast 20,000 Hertz. We'll link you to all sorts of stuff at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Dallas, for talking to us about deepfake audio.
Thank you.
And of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Have you been pranked or worse by deepfake audio? Let us know. hereandnow.org. A federal judge is putting the brakes on the Trump administration's ban on TikTok. After hearing yesterday, the judge temporarily blocked Trump's ban just before it was supposed to go into effect last night, stopping all U.S. downloads of the Chinese-owned social media app. Meanwhile, the terms of a deal to create a U.S.-based TikTok Global remain up in the air. So let's bring in NPR business correspondent Shannon Bond. And Shannon, this latest tick in the TikTok story was the U.S. District Court in D.C. granting this temporary injunction against Trump's ban on downloads of TikTok from U.S. app stores. So tell us a little more about that ruling and reasoning.
That's right. Well, the judge sided with TikTok, at least for now. Now, his full ruling was issued yesterday under seal. It's just been unsealed. What we know is that during the hearing on Sunday, TikTok argued that the ban was a blow to free speech and accused President Trump of playing politics ahead of the election. The company says there just isn't credible evidence to back up the national security fears that the Trump administration said were the reason for this ban. So what this means for now is TikTok can stay at least until a full hearing is scheduled.
Well, they must be pretty happy. You can tell us more about that. But also, the judge didn't block a broader ban set to take effect on November 12th that could make TikTok unusable in the U.S. So there's still that looming deadline. What do they have to do about that?
Right. I mean, this is really just a short break that TikTok has caught here. And it does say it's pleased with this ruling. You know, it had warned the ban would be devastating. It estimated that 90% of U.S. users might never come back if the app was banned for 6 months. But now it's really got to move to figuring out a solution that will allow it to keep operating for over the long term. You mentioned, Robin, this November 12th deadline. That's a big deal. That's when the Trump administration says TikTok has to find an American owner or be kicked out of the U.S. entirely. So, you know, we've seen there's been so much scrambling to hammer out a deal that will both satisfy the White House and authorities in Beijing, because, of course, TikTok's owner, ByteDance, is a Chinese company.
Yeah, and that's the deal among Oracle, Walmart, and TikTok's parent company, ByteDance. The Commerce Department says it will continue to defend President Trump's executive order, which it says promotes legitimate national security interests. And just remind us what the government has identified as a security threat to Americans who use TikTok.
Right. So what the government is worried about is this idea that the Chinese Communist Party could access TikTok data on American users. You know, and broadly, experts who look at this say, you know, there is like a concern that there is, you know, interplay between companies and the government and China. But it's really unclear whether that's an actual risk here in the TikTok case. In the legal filings, the government called the CEO of ByteDance a mouthpiece of the Communist Party and says it has evidence that some data is being transmitted to China, but it didn't give any direct evidence that U.S. user data of TikTok has ever been accessed by officials in Beijing. And of course, TikTok denies this. It says it doesn't store data on American users in China, doesn't share it with Beijing. Clearly, the White House is not buying that.
Yeah. We just have a few seconds left here. What do analysts think? I mean, what do people think might happen?
Well, the real question here is, can they satisfy this push for American ownership with this deal that TikTok is trying to work out with Oracle and Walmart? They would bring those two companies in as partners and investors in a new company. President Trump has given that deal his tentative blessing, but since then there have been these contradictory statements, and fundamentally it's not clear whether ByteDance would still have a stake in TikTok or not.
Okay, well, make your TikTok videos while you can. NPR business correspondent Shannon Bond, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
With coronavirus infection rates declining in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis gave restaurants the green light to open at full capacity this weekend for the first time since pandemic restrictions began. On Friday, DeSantis said waiting for a vaccine before going to phase three of reopening would be too damaging to the restaurant industry.
I don't think that's viable. I don't think that that is acceptable. And so I think that this will be very, very important to the industry. And it also will be a recognition that they have worked as hard as anybody to create safe environments.
Well, let's see how business was over the weekend. JT Corrales is the Director of Business Development for Krabby Bill's in Indian Rocks Beach, Florida, outside Tampa. JT, welcome. I know this was a big deal for you. How'd the weekend go?
You know, it was really interesting. Friday night, we walked outside because we have indoor and outdoor dining. And you could just feel the energy, you know. I mean, it was one thing for us within our walls to have our capacity come back up to 100%. But I think it was another for consumer confidence and just that feeling of safety. And maybe we've turned the corner and things are on their way back to being normal again.
So you were at 100% capacity. It was rocking, as you say.
Yeah, we had a great Friday night, great Saturday. Yes, it was. It felt good.
Wow. So how badly did the pandemic hurt that business and your employees over the past several months?
Oh, tremendously. I mean, at the beginning of it, when we pretty much locked everything down, I mean, we had to close all of our businesses. So we have 7 restaurants in the area, 500 employees pre-pandemic. And we, you know, we had to go to a full layoff for every employee that we had. And I remember giving the last speech before we had to let everybody go. And I mean, that was very uncertain and dark. And, you know, we're a business 38 years standing here in Indian Rocks Beach. So it's, you never think that you'd have to give that speech. So a lot of uncertainty and little by little as per phase 1, 2, and 3, like we got a little bit more of a fighting chance. And finally, you know, with this one here, we feel like we might find our way out.
And how many of those 500 employees have you been able to hire back?
Somewhere in the low 300s.
Yeah. So still working on getting back to normal. But the new state rules that DeSantis issued say that if local governments want to keep restrictions of their own beyond 50% capacity, they have to justify that decision. Do you have any local rules where you are that you still have to abide by?
The only thing that's really a focal point is the mandate for the mask in our county. But aside from that, we haven't gotten any pushback of any kind. And we feel that it's full go at this point.
So JT, I think the obvious question is, you know, if your business is full, if the restaurant is packed, what are you doing to keep people safe inside Krabby Bill's?
Well, I mean, all the things that we've been conditioned to do prior to COVID. You know, I mean, outside of hospitals and dentists, you know, we've had to maintain very sanitary spaces. We've had to make sure we train and educate our staff on, you know, changing their cutting boards, changing their knives, washing their hands, you know, because there's already enough liability out there in this industry. So we feel confident that we can provide a safe environment for our customers.
So it sounds like you're saying you're taking no special COVID precautions. You're not spacing out the tables or keeping the windows open. Your servers aren't necessarily wearing masks.
Servers are wearing masks, yes.
Okay. But, you know, just because you can open doesn't necessarily mean it's a great idea from a public health standpoint. You know, scientists say that restaurants and bars have been spreaders of COVID. And I mean, as I'm sure you saw, Florida just passed 700,000 cases this weekend since the pandemic began. Are you worried that, you know, at this level of opening, your restaurant could be the source of an outbreak? And what happens if it is?
No, not at all. I think that for every one bit of data that you hear from one scientist or one study, you hear another piece that is contrary to that. So my perspective from the beginning of this has been, I don't think that there has been any right or wrong answer throughout the process. But at this stage, I mean, we can only control what we can control within our walls. Hmm.
And do you have a plan if somebody gets sick, if one of your servers does or a customer, what will you do?
We've already had to encounter that in the past in the reopening. You know, we've had to allow the staff member to stay home. We've traced who they worked with. If anybody was close to that staff member during their shifts, then we've asked them to stay home as well. So I believe that we've done a good job in mitigating that in the past.
Yeah. JT Corrales is Director of Business Development for Krabby Bill's in Indian Rocks Beach, Florida. It's just outside of Tampa Bay. JT, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in a scientist, Dr. Cindy Prince, an epidemiologist at the University of Florida. Dr. Prince, welcome. And when I asked JT whether he was concerned that opening a restaurant at 100% capacity would spread the disease, he said, no, not concerned. What do you think?
Well, I think I have a different opinion on that. I do have my concerns about restaurants being opened at 100% capacity. And of course, I base that concern on the fact that 100% capacity is going to mean for many restaurants that we're not able to maintain social distancing while eating out. And in addition to that, add in the fact that you're not going to wear a mask while you're eating in the restaurant. And those two things together, we know, are risk factors for COVID-19 infection.
Infections in Florida have been going down now for a while, trending down at least. So do you think that Governor DeSantis is making a mistake here?
Well, I think that I understand the economic implications of, you know, what's been happening in our restaurant industry, and that, you know, this is opening up for people to have more choice in what they want to do. I do have some concerns about the level of cases in Florida. They've been trending down, but, you know, we're still relatively high compared to where we were when we came out of some of the stricter stay-at-home orders in the earlier phases of reopening. And so to me, I do have concern that as we open up more and more, as we send a message to people that, you know, things are sort of back to the status quo, that we're going to see an increase in infections again.
Hmm. JT Corrales did tell us that his servers are wearing masks, but otherwise they're taking just sort of standard sanitary precautions. You know, they're washing hands as they did before the pandemic. Under what circumstances do you think a restaurant could reopen safely? And you know, since the cat's out of the bag now anyways and restaurants are open, what should they be doing?
Absolutely. I think it is important for the servers to wear masks consistently and wear them properly. So that means a mask that fits well and is over both the nose and the mouth. These are folks who are going to get more exposure to people in the restaurant, especially now that restaurants are opening to fuller capacity. And so I do worry about them being at risk. I would also say that restaurants really should do their own risk assessment. You know, every restaurant is set up differently. There are some where even at full capacity, you may have a good amount of distance between tables. But, you know, I think we've all also been to restaurants where, you know, the tables are very close by, where you might as well introduce yourself to your neighbor because you're going to be sitting very near them while you're dining out. And, you know, for those restaurants, I would ask them really to assess, you know, how close their tables are, whether they can continue to have people eat outdoors instead of indoors, and really think about that risk of transmission in their own facility.
Well, what about you personally? You're an epidemiologist. Have you eaten at a restaurant yet since this pandemic broke out?
I haven't. I do continue to get takeout from the restaurants that I enjoy. I'm trying to support my local restaurants by doing that. But I am not ready to eat out at a restaurant yet for me. It's just not a risk that I'm looking to take.
Well, there are new warnings across the country that the virus will surge again in the fall and the winter. How are you feeling big picture about the state of this pandemic as we leave the summer behind? And while maybe people will be spending more time outdoors in Florida, across the rest of the country, people are going to be heading back inside once the cooler weather comes.
Right. I have some concerns about that. I mean, this pandemic has been an evolution of us understanding and learning how to deal with it and how to live with it to some extent. And certainly we've learned a lot about, you know, the need to wear masks and that need to social distance and really the positive impact that can have on reducing the number of cases of COVID-19. But, you know, as we move indoors, that does become more of an issue of people, you know, wanting to still continue at their activities, to continue socializing and not having that added benefit of being in the open air where we know at least there's some effect on reducing transmission. So it does definitely become a concern as we move into the fall, into the winter, as more things open up and as people just become really fatigued at dealing with this pandemic over time.
Dr. Cindy Prince is an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Florida. Thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We all know polls can be misleading, but so can group socialized moods. What is that? Well, for instance, Derek Thompson writes that many Democrats have grown pessimistic in recent weeks as they brace for an unorthodox election and the possibility that President Trump won't accept a peaceful transfer of power. But despite this dark mood among many on the left, Nate Silver at 538 is clocking Biden's chances of winning right now at 78%, compared to 57.8% for Hillary Clinton at this point in the 2016 campaign. So where are these numbers coming from, and should voters even pay attention, or, for Democrats anyway, stick with this group socialized despair? Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. Derek, hi.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And we should say you agree with Nate Silver in that 2020 is very different from 2016 in a way that you say favors Biden. So explain that first.
Yeah, I think there's two really big important differences between 2020 and 2016. The first is that Biden's advantage over Trump is a lot larger than Hillary Clinton's was at this time in the race 4 years ago. And second, it's more durable. It's more consistent. And that's in large part because there are fewer undecided voters in 2020 than there were in 2016. Both of these, I think, are relatively good pieces of news for Biden. There are other important signs that you could take if you were looking for pieces of optimism about the Biden campaign. He's doing better in Arizona. He's doing better among the white working class in the upper Midwest, in Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. But the two most important things that I'm looking at are the durability of Biden's lead and its size, which really has not fallen below 6 percentage points on average since really before this pandemic started. In many ways, you could say this has been a really boring general election season because the gap between Biden and Trump has been so, so steady.
And for people screaming at their radios, Nate Silver got it wrong in 2016. We'll get to that. But first, what about the role of undecided voters? Because both parties are saying there just aren't that many of them.
Yeah, this is a really important point that I actually don't see a lot of people talking about enough. One of the reasons why 2016 was a surprisingly difficult election to forecast is that this time, 4 years ago, September 28th, 2016, one in six voters, 16% of the electorate, was undecided or committed to voting for someone like Gary Johnson. Today, it's not 16% of Americans who aren't committed to either the Republican or Democrat. It's 7% 8%, a lot lower. And that's important because undecided voters are a measure of uncertainty. You don't know how they're going to vote because they don't know how they're going to vote. And what we saw in 2016, I think, in the closing weeks, was that, you know, it looked like a lot of Americans changing their minds or making up their minds at the very last second. And those late mind makers were changing or making up their minds to vote for Trump, especially in that upper Midwest region where he eked out the most surprising victories. So if you have a smaller number of undecided voters, you could say that puts a limit, a boundary around how large your election night surprise is going to be. Like, of course, what we saw 4 years ago, which is that state polls were wrong. That could happen again. But you're not going to have something like 16% of the electorate make up its minds in the last 5 weeks. The vast, vast, vast majority of Americans knows which camp they're going to vote for, and there isn't a large cohort that's holding out for a third party.
And is this partly explaining why Nate Silver and others, you know, were so wrong about Hillary Clinton at this point in the campaign in 2016? He said she had a 57.8% chance of winning. Is this why you are more receptive to his model this year that puts Biden at 78%?
Yeah, I respect Nate. I don't know his methodology exactly, so I can't reach in there and pluck out the weeds of methodological difference that I have with him. But let me say this. 4 years ago this day, September 28th, Hillary Clinton was up 1.9% in an average of polls. Today, Biden is up just over 7%. So he's up 5 percentage points more than Hillary Clinton was 4 years ago exactly. Also, she was just polling around 43%. Again, there were all these undecided voters. Today, Biden is at just over 50%. That's really important. Those are really significant differences. I think that we look back 4 years ago to the surprise that so many of us felt on that November night when Trump won, and forget that this was a really close election. This was a dynamic election. Trump was up in a lot of general election polls in September, not maybe so many, but in a few really important general election polls in September and October, Trump was up. He's down between 5, 8, 10% now in most general election polls from highly graded pollsters. So yes, of course, the state polls can be wrong again. Trump could absolutely become a president for another 4 years. But I think we make this mistake by forgetting how much closer 2016 was compared to 2020 has been so far.
So you're saying avoid group socialized moods, pay attention to some of this, this math that you're laying out for us. And of course, it could all change because we're digesting explosive news from the Times and tomorrow is the first debate. Everything could change. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here Now.
Police in Texas have been using hypnosis to solve crimes since the 1980s. But how accurate is this technique? We'll take a deeper look next time, Here and Now.